Welcome on. We are back with actual game recaps of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. I've been missing doing these because I was in Santa Cruz for the D-League Showcase for a little bit. Didn't have a chance to. We've had to get into some deeper content. But now we are back with ephemeral content that will be useless by the time you've probably listened to this already. That's not true because we try to take away some larger little things from the games. Danny, what's up?
I wanted to express my admiration to you for a very specific reason. I watched the last 2 minutes of Pelicans-Lakers and could not believe that you handled more of it than that.
Well, the part with D'Angelo Russell actually was pretty enjoyable. He had an excellent game. He's really making some strides. I think his rookie season is now at the point where it's going about as well as you could have hoped. And he's shown a lot of growth finishing with his right hand. He had a stretch in the late third quarter, early fourth quarter, you know, when Byron Scott actually deigned to put him in the game, when he was just every pick and roll that he ran was flawless. And, it's not like he has a murderer's row of shooters and roll men to work with here, but he was just making the right pass every time. It was beautiful. And then he went out with about 6 minutes left and never returned.
Yeah. But do you want to start with a better game or do you want to start there?
I think we should start there because that'll force people to want to listen to further into the podcast when we actually talk about the good games. Although, I mean, there's a lot of Lakers fans out there, and I guess it's really kind of funny because the Pels, theoretically, are still trying to win. AD is out with that contusion on his back that he got diving into the stands. And they lost, and they are now – I looked at their – playoff odds on ESPN's BPI, which has replaced Hollinger's playoff odds, they had like a 6% chance or something going into the night. And I would imagine losing to the Lakers has lowered that quite a bit now as well.
I would think so.
Yeah, I mean, they were projected to finish 33-49 before this. And, I mean, I think, are they 11-26 now?
11-26, yep.
Oof. So what do they have to do? What would they have to do to get to like 39 wins? They'd have to go 28 and what the rest of the way?
Give me a second. Yeah, I mean,
they would have to play basically like 600 ball or better to get to even 38 wins at this point, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. It's crazy to think about just like where this team is. That it's this desolate already, but that's really where things are. I mean, and that's, remember, this was, we expected that the West playoff picture was going to be a lot better than this. This is not.
Yeah. I mean, getting to 500 would seem basically completely impossible for them now after this recent downturn. When they were like 11-22, you could still maybe hope that if they could just like snap their fingers, like instantly start playing as well as they did at various times last year, that they could get there. That's just not going to happen. And, this was, again, I mean, Bob Bulgaris has been killing Alvin Gentry, and it's really, I did not agree with a lot of what he was doing in this game.
So it's a nice round number, so it'll be nice for listeners. They need to win 60% of their games the rest of the way to get to 38.
Yeah, and 38 still probably doesn't even get it done. I mean, I think that is about the lowest it's been, even at like the East's nadirs these last few years. There might have been a year when there was a 37. I don't think so, though. I think 38 wins is like the lowest to get in basically, this millennium.
Well, and the thing that stuck out to me, of course, you watched more of the game than I did, was down the stretch, both teams were calling timeouts basically every change of possession, yet they still, both teams, but it was more notable to me with the Pelicans, just basically had offense-only lineups out there. And I was just sitting there going, well, if you're going to call a timeout, then just put defensive guys out there.
Yeah, and you could say, all right, so the Lakers were closing with, they did not have Russell out there. They had Lou Williams, who actually, was pretty good down the end. Anthony Braun, their one, thing even approaching a defensive player. Clarkson. And then they had Randall and Nance up front. And then the Pels countered that with Ryan Anderson at center, Alonzo G at the four, Norris Cole at the one with no Eric Gordon, Tyreek Evans and Drew Holiday, and they actually like struggled to score pretty badly. It was really, you know, it was shocking to me that when you're going with Randall and Nance, two guys who can't shoot at all on the other team, that you wouldn't go with Ajinsa or Ashik, someone who can protect the rim a little bit. This isn't like it's some good shooting Lakers team, and the Lakers just paraded to the rim down the end of the game.
Yeah, so you can help off those guys. You can do a lot of different things. And then another point towards the end that you noted as well is that Drew Holiday on one of the last possessions of the game made a gamble for a steal. And when you're playing with no rim protection, you have to defend that a little bit differently, because if you miss, it's almost a guaranteed basket for the other team. So you have to treat that differently than like if Rudy Gobert is back there and you can think, okay, we can mitigate this risk. And Drew just didn't on that possession.
That was awful. Let me tell you what the last four possessions of the game were: two offense, two defense, or two defense, two offense for New Orleans. I think they had a 1-point lead, and Julius Randle gets the ball on, I think, an offensive rebound, and he kind of just like meanders into the lane, muscles his way past Alonzo G. Larry Nance was standing just in the middle of nowhere, 15 feet from the basket, not even on the baseline in the dunker spot. Ryan Anderson was guarding him, was standing maybe like 3 feet away from Randall's intended path and just never moved towards him. Sort of took like a half-hearted feint as Randall just powered his way right in for an open layup to give the Lakers the lead. Then they come down after a timeout, I believe. They don't go with Eric Gordon on the floor. And it's Tyreek Evans with a step-back three-pointer. He had made a couple of threes, admittedly, and they were going for the two-for-one. But it was just it was definitely an ugly, not a high-percentage shot, especially when, you know, you are down one. Going for a three is a little bit questionable. They come back. The Lakers are milking the clock. There's still about a 10-second differential. Drew Holiday goes for the steal at midcourt on Lou Williams, just a total low-percentage play. Lou just rolls right in. As you said, there was no one there to protect the rim. Lou scores right over. Well, I guess there was. Anderson was there. He did make an effort this time, but he was not going to deter Lou Williams. Lou scores, puts him up three, and then it's another Tyreek step-back three that bricks. Lou gets a nice rebound, and that's your game. It was really just the worst four possessions you'll ever see from a team in crunch time.
I cracked up because, as some listeners may know, I'm a big fan of the NBA 2K games, and I actually send their dev team comments, and one that I was working on, because I was working on an email for them, is that one of the few flaws in the current game is that I think they tether too much big guys to big guys who can't shoot, and then I watch that play, and I'm like, crap, maybe they're right. Like, and I was saying, they're like, I actually have that Word document in my drafts, and I'm like, that would be something to correct in 2K17, and I'm sitting there going, well, maybe they just need to correct it for guys who have high defensive awareness, and they can just do something with that on it.
Yeah, no, that's a good idea. I mean, this is New Orleans had so many record scratches in this game. How do you not go with Tyreek, Drew Holiday, Eric Gordon, Ryan Anderson at the four, and then a center? To me, how you could go with G and Cole, who aren't stopping anybody anyway. It's not like they were like killing it defensively, and they couldn't score against, you know, one of the worst defense in the league, although maybe the Pelicans are rapidly overtaking them. So it was just a microcosm. Yeah, the Pelicans have had injuries. If you don't look at what they're doing closely, that is a big excuse, but they just have not defended at all from the start of the year and have made a lot of really weird, no chance lineups out there. All right, you want to get to like a real basketball game? This was actually an awesome game.
I'll say one quick thing before.
Okay.
A quick shout out to our friend Seth Partno, who I think was the best person at beating the drum, saying people who are giving the Pelicans a lot of credit for a coaching upgrade, maybe they should pump the brakes on it a little bit. And I think that they've had a lot of worst case scenarios, but I think that was a very astute point that, like, I think a lot of us, including myself, overplayed at the time.
Yeah, and maybe, I think we all kind of felt that way. Maybe we're just overrating Gentry. I still don't think that Monty Williams was like unbelievable or anything, or maybe we're just overrating the defensive talent that was on this team. Maybe AD, despite all of his physical gifts, just isn't really that good. Maybe Jrue Holiday isn't really that good anymore after all the injuries. Maybe Tyreek and Eric Gordon are just so bad that there's just no overcoming those guys. But I mean, the thing is like the Pelicans haven't defended this year, and they've played some like really record scratchy, ostensibly defensive lineups with guys like G and Cole all the time.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to actual basketball.
Yeah. This was actually one of my favorite games of the year. This, Mavs Cavs game.
Okay, so where do you want to start? Where do you want to start with this one? There are a lot of different places you can go, the beginning, the end, just the overall scope of the game.
Well, I loved the strategic matchup. I thought it was really interesting. Early on in the game, Chandler Parsons actually had one of his best games of the year with 25 points. And the Cavs starters actually were outscored pretty badly by the Mavs starters for most of the game. They were able to get back into it with their reserve unit. Timofey Mozgov, we had talked about him really struggling on the show of guys who cost themselves money. He actually had maybe his best game of the year. I think he had 10 points, 9 rebounds in about 20 minutes, and was something like plus 18 on the game. Dellavedova also another just, you know, great plus-minus performance. I mean, any plus-minus metrics is just loving what he's doing so far this year.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because it kind of makes sense when you really think about it that the lineups that he generally plays in, you don't need him to create very much, and if he plays defense and hits open shots, that's really what you need. But in some ways, you know, it's nice to have a lower usage guy out there with everybody else.
Yeah, I agree, and you know, he's still got his couple of pick and roll lobs, and Dele, despite being 4 of 11, was 4 of 7 on threes. That would make him 0 of 4 on twos, of course, but he still had a couple of those lobs. Anyway, the Cavs overall did not shoot incredibly well. Kevin Love had 19 shot attempts, Irving 20. Love was only 5 out of 19, 3 of 9 on threes, but he did get on the offensive glass for 6 offensive rebounds, including some really key ones down the stretch. And in overtime, LeBron continues to shoot much better. Like, there was actually, it was noted that he saw either a tweet or an article by John Schumann saying that he was basically the worst shooter in the league. And since then, he has apparently changed his shooting routine. He's shooting now before games instead of just at shoot-around. And, you know, whether you want to say it's luck or psychological or it's just random variance, he has shot the ball excellently ever since then.
Yeah, I was watching the same broadcast you and was fascinated that, you know, that made it all the way to him. It did go pretty big when it happened because it was kind of shocking that he was the worst shooter outside of the paint in the league at the time. And, you know, when LeBron is on in that way, that's what makes him so hard to defend. And even when his shot isn't falling, I mean, he had some moments in this game that felt more like 27, 28-year-old LeBron, though it was moments, not the whole game.
Yeah. On both ends, actually.
Yeah.
And, but getting back to the strategic component, Parsons did a lot of his damage. He was 10 out of 14 from the field, 3 of 6 on threes. He did a lot of his damage against Kevin Love when Love was playing at the 4, and Parsons, the Mavs were playing small with the second unit. He was able to come off screens, get some open shots, drive to the basket on Love. So that was very encouraging to see him be able to do that, you know, not against a great defender, but, you know, he's not a guy who's normally going to beat guys one-on-one. Just to see him, and he also played 40 minutes in this game as well, coming back from that knee surgery. Still doesn't look quite as explosive as he did, but just the fact that he's able to have a game like this, very encouraging. Then the fireworks really started when Cleveland went with Kevin Love at the 5.
Yeah, and that coincided, from what I remember, with the Mavs going back to their bigger lineup and playing Dirk and Zaza. So then you kind of got the clash of cultures, if you will.
And people don't realize this, but that lineup with Love at the 5 has been absolutely killing it. And it should. I mean, you got Kyrie, who did not look amazing in this game, but had some big buckets late. You've got LeBron, Love's shooting, spacing everybody out, and then he can post if need be against a mismatch. And I do owe Clevelanders an apology. I said that Love, you know, wasn't a guy you wanted to go to on post-ups. I think that's true still against good defense and against guys his size, but he has been very efficient so far this year attacking mismatches. So that was a little bit not quite nuanced enough what I said back then. And so people think that lineup doesn't work because with Love at center in the Christmas games, but that's against the Warriors. You know, that lineup has been very effective against other teams. And the Mavs are in such a difficult situation because Dirk obviously can't protect the rim. He's also really too slow to guard anyone on the perimeter. But, you know, he also causes his own matchup problems when the other team tries to go small as well. And then they decided that they're going to counter that by putting LeBron on him, and that's when it got really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's what's so much fun about Dirk in those situations is exactly what you said, that he creates mismatches on both sides, so it basically kind of guarantees interesting basketball. It doesn't necessarily guarantee good basketball. We could see that with part of overtime. But, yeah, I mean, LeBron on him totally changed the dynamic.
Yeah, because he is still fantastic at doing that when he's really locked in. And he had a couple of lapses, like one where Dirk hit a three on him where he just sort of stood at the free throw line and didn't close out. Like, you have to run Dirk off the line at this point, at least make him shoot a two or drive, which he's not really capable of doing. Dirk has almost no chance of finishing at the rim anymore either. We saw that late.
Well, yeah, and that LeBron, the LeBron one, if we're thinking of the same play, he had this kind of instinct probably in his head that he should rim protect just because there wasn't anybody really there. But when you, like, for me, when you think about it, I can't remember who the guys involved in the Dallas action were. But a Dirk three is probably the most dangerous thing that can happen on that play, and he left him open.
Meanwhile, Dirk was guarding Amon Shumpert on the other side, really the most non-threatening option that they could give him. And Shumpert, you know, he's an okay three-point shooter, more so from the corners than above the break. But he had a couple of nice right-handed drives on Dirk, one of which he missed the layup on, the other one in which he just completely blew right by him. And then there was nobody else really available to help. They tried going with Pachulia guarding Love, but that's, you know, a tall order even for Zaza, who's a smart defender, to get all the way out to Love at the three-point line and still provide some modicum of rim protection as well. But I still thought that going with the center was their best approach, because if you have Dirk as your center, you're just never going to protect the basket at all. And the Cavaliers really smelled blood in the water as soon as Carlisle went to Dirk at center down the last 2 minutes or so of the overtime.
And the ancillary players for Dallas can't really provide supplementary rim protection. So you're basically kind of, it's an all or nothing proposition. And Cleveland is a very different calculus than a team like the Warriors. You know, obviously you still want to prevent certain things, but a layup line against them is just devastating because they can do that better than they can shoot threes.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and Love, you know, he's not shooting an unbelievable percentage on threes. Now, he probably has more of a reputation than his actual shooting would suggest at this point. You know, he can take a lot of shots, but he's not going to have like an unbelievable conversion rate. But giving up a three to him is not like great, but when you have to pick your poison like that, maybe you might consider it. There were just some pretty iconic plays in this game too. There was Deron Williams getting the switch on Tristan Thompson, blowing by him for a 2-point lead. Then LeBron came back and dunked all over Devin Harris after they ran the Clippers double high play, but they actually had Kyrie as one of the two guys setting the screen. The other guy was Love, and Zaza tried to step out. He couldn't play normal pick and roll defense due to Love's shooting ability, and then LeBron went right to the rim, dunked all over Devin Harris. It should have been an and one. He didn't get it. Tied the game. And then there are plays down the stretch too. LeBron scared the crap out of Deron Williams as he was trying to go in for what he thought was going to be an easy layup. LeBron came out of nowhere to make a miss. Mark Cuban and the Dallas broadcast crew were up in arms because LeBron hit the backboard as the shot was in the air and supposedly really made it shake a lot. But that shot wasn't going in anyway. I think that was really, you know, a big distraction, and there are plenty of other things that went wrong for them in the game.
Yeah, there's kind of a letter versus the spirit of the law thing there. My interpretation of it, I haven't seen a really clear replay of it, but when I was seeing it at the time, was it's kind of the equivalent of pass interference on an uncatchable ball. You know, it's like I don't want to see goaltending called if the ball had no chance, because then all you want to disincentivize that conduct. But what was so funny to me wasn't as much that they were talking about it, especially Cuban with the tweet after the fact, but the broadcasters stopped talking about the game to talk about the goaltend that didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's one thing if the guy hits the ball or the ball is like right on the rim and you hit the backboard and you can see the vibrating rim like knocks it out or something. But I
or if it's in a stoppage. It was not in a stoppage. The game was still going.
Yeah. No, that's true. I just really enjoyed all the great individual plays in this game. I mean, Shumpert, Dirk was isolated on Shumpert, and Shumpert, knowing that he really likes to go right shoulder pretty much all the time, but especially when he's ISO'd at the free throw line, was all over it, just stripped him away on a key bucket, I think, at the end of regulation. That was a really awesome play. Also, a little bit of controversy as Blatt had LeBron inbound the ball with, I think, 0.9 seconds left after Shumpert stripped Dirk. You would think that LeBron, as a guy who can get his shot off over anybody, you would want to throw it to him. But they did actually have some success with Kyrie, I think, against San Antonio last year with LeBron inbounding the ball. They tried a similar play, but it just went awry.
Didn't LeBron make one of those shots against Orlando in the playoffs when he was on when he was a Cav the first time?
Yes.
Over Hedo.
I think it was game two of the 2009 Eastern Conference Finals.
We also need to talk about one of the greatest grenades that I've seen in a big moment, especially from LeBron, who's usually so smart about it. That play, like the last Cavs offensive possession of the game, was mind-blowing to me.
Refresh your memory. Which one are you talking
about?
Darren
Williams flops. LeBron is standing there at the free throw. LeBron is standing there at the free throw line.
No, he was wide open. That was the right pass.
You mean when Kyrie was when Kyrie was 35 feet away?
I wasn't 35 feet. I was like a 28.
LeBron had a 15 footer, and he gave it to Kyrie with a second left.
All right. So the play. Now that you are reminding me, I guess I couldn't identify it because I disagree with you that it was the wrong play. So they get the switch. You know, they do their usual 3-1 pick and roll. They get the switch with D-Will. LeBron drives into the elbow. D-Will with just a terrible flop. He had two ridiculous flops in the overtime. One of them he got away with because Love, who is guarding on a switch, missed a tip in. But the other one, how you could flop there at just that incredibly critical time and just decide, what kind of a competitor says, I know what to do. I'm going to just like roll the dice with seeing whether a ref calls this instead of just like trying to stop the guy. You know, that behavior kind of galls me. So then, whoever was guarding Curry, I want to say maybe it was like Wes Matthews, sprinted over to LeBron because he had basically a wide open 15 footer. But you know, Wes got there quickly enough that I didn't think that actually was a great shot for LeBron. And then they threw it back to Kyrie and he hit the three as the shot clock buzzer expired to put him up four and basically end it, because then Rick Carlisle decided to go for a quick two with 12 seconds left in the game. And D-Will, of course, as always happens, drove in, stopped on a dime, tried to like up fake and then got stripped, never even got a shot off for his quick two. So just another example of how that two part of the quick two does not happen as often as you think it does.
If only Dallas had good 3-point shooters.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I thought this was just an awesome game. I love the strategy of it. I thought that Carlisle actually, that Blatt made some mistakes on the stretch with going to Dirk at center. I mean, Cleveland basically got great shots every single time from that point on, which I think he did it with about a minute 30 left in the second overtime. And I thought that Blatt going small, I mean, Blatt even went with LeBron at center on some of those late plays defensively. He got Love out of the game and when they were trying to go for a three. So it was a lot of interesting strategy. Dirk guarding LeBron, or LeBron guarding Dirk, was fantastic. Really one of my favorite games of the season.
Yeah, and you always hope that a game that you attend in person or watch on TV is going to be that good, and fortunately we have a way that you can do that.
Yes, we do. That would be SeatGeek, my friends. Whether you're looking to buy tickets to a game or sell tickets that you can't use, you should check out SeatGeek, the inaugural sponsor of the Dunked On Basketball podcast, and the smartest way to buy and sell tickets for your favorite sports team. SeatGeek is my go-to for buying and selling tickets. It's really easy because it's an app on your phone. You don't have to bother with capture or anything like that. You put in your information and you can then just with one click buy your tickets. SeatGeek aggregates all of the ticket buying sites together, so you don't have to worry that you're not getting the cheapest deal. And for a not limited time only, because hopefully they will sponsor us forever, my listeners can download the free SeatGeek app and get a free $20 by adding the promo code CAPSPACE, that's all one word, under the settings tab. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first ticket purchase using that CAPSPACE promo code.
So do you want to go to Pistons Spurs now?
Yeah, this was another game that I was interested to see. I was glad, as I've often lamented, I'll watch the Eastern Time Zone games, and by the time they're over, the Spurs game is over. So the fact that the Spurs game was in Eastern Time Zone let me watch most of a Spurs game. They were incredibly impressive in this game, I thought, especially offensively more than defensively, because I don't think Detroit provides a ton of challenges other than Drummond on the offensive glass. But Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker were fantastic in this game. They just roasted Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, who had had one of the better games that we saw in person defending Steph Curry.
And that does get into the idea of, you know, that certain players are good defensively in some situations and can struggle in others, though I think that with more time and experience, he'll get better at handling the more crafty guys.
Yeah, that's true. And I think just he was just really, really up for that game. And just in terms of the intelligence level, although Steph is pretty darn good, just with the ball in their hands, the craftiness that Parker and Manu had, especially on the days when they're feeling good. So Parker, best game of the season. He was 13 out of 19 from the field, 31 points, even made a three, just was getting to the rim whenever he wanted. At one point, he was 9 out of 10 in the second half, just went absolutely crazy. I think he made his first 7 shots of the third quarter, and he was just getting in the lane, abusing guys with his pick-and-roll craft, snaking the pick-and-roll, which for those who don't know, that's basically, it'll oftentimes happen where you set a pick-and-roll on the left side of the floor, and especially if the other team tries to ice you, so the idea is to keep them out of the middle of the floor, the guy will set the screen. You know, if you imagine the defender where he's standing to try and keep a guy on the left side of the floor out of the middle of the floor, the screen will actually set the screen on the defender's right shoulder and then kind of roll to the basket from the side. And Parker, what he'll do, and a lot of the good point guards, Chris Paul, do this too, is they snake the pick and roll. They actually then go back towards the middle of the floor. That really messes up the defense because the help side and the strong side get changed by that. And so you have to reorient what your assignment is. And he was amazing in faking out the big man. Usually the big man will come help out. And then as soon as the guard can get back to him, the big man will try to retreat to his man. Parker, a couple of times, just faked out Andre Drummond really badly by making it look like Pope was back in position. He wasn't, and then he just went right in for a floater. He had that floater working incredibly well. He had the mid-range working well. And then the next time down, he did the same thing, knew that Drummond was going to come over and pay more attention to him, just threw it right out to LaMarcus Aldridge at the top of the key for an easy jumper. Aldridge had another nice game. He was 10 out of 19 from the field, and he had 5 offensive boards. He's offensive rebounding at one of the better rates that he's had. It's just a very impressive game from the Spurs. Their defense wasn't at an unbelievable level in this game, but the offense more than made up for it.
Yeah, and against a team like Detroit, if you can kind of push it on either end, that would probably be enough at the talent level that the Spurs had. And what I thought, I didn't watch as much of this game as you did, though I wanted to, that was my full intention, was how devastating the pick and roll can be as the foundational piece if both components of it are as good as the Spurs guys are, you know, because then there aren't a lot of ways to really solve it. You can just do certain things to try to mitigate the damage.
Yeah, Kawhi Leonard went 1 for 7 in this game and in 34 minutes only had 7 points, and the Spurs had no problem scoring against what's a pretty decent Pistons defense just due to the effort that Parker was going to have. And we said this many times, but everyone shoveling dirt on Tony Parker's grave was very premature. From the Pistons' standpoint, if KCP is not going to be able to guard very well, they're in trouble because one of the discussions I had at the showcase was about Reggie Jackson's defense and how they always hide him usually on the two or the one if the guy's less of a threat. Whoever's less of a threat, they let KCP guard the bigger threat. And so if Reggie Jackson has to actually guard someone, which was the case when they had Manu and Parker together against those two guys, the Pistons are in trouble there. And the biggest thing that I took away for the Pistons, Aron Baynes had a pretty good game, although he ended up 6 out of 13. He did have 15 points against his old team. But Andre Drummond was very good, but only shot 1 of 6 from the free throw line. and Stan Van Gundy was just afraid to go to him in the fourth quarter when they were trying to make a comeback.
And that's the goal of Hacka, isn't it? Really, at its most basic level?
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, Pop has a reputation that he will go to that, obviously, but he didn't even have to. I think Van Gundy was, I think he part of it was just using an excuse that he, you know, Baines was playing okay, but you know, Baines is not Andre Drummond, and a lot of what they were able to do offensively in the third quarter was due to Drummond's offensive rebounding and the threat he had with the lob on pick and roll. And Pope, well, we did slam his defense. He did have 25 points on 14 shots in this game. So he at least helped keep him in it offensively. And he also had to play 43 minutes. He's playing a ridiculous number of minutes.
Yeah. Anything else in this game, or you want to move on?
Well, I just will reiterate it, especially for new listeners. We talked about this a lot during the playoffs last year. I think that if you have a big star center that just you are way worse without him on the floor, both in a single game standpoint and just in a macro standpoint with the league, you should just leave him out there and just let him get fouled. Even, you know, make them foul him 30 times a game, you know, or 20 times a game. At some point, they're going to get some of their good players in foul trouble. You're not going to lose that much because they're always going against your set defense, or they're going to have to put in some of their bad players to keep fouling you. Just make it into a complete farce. And in the course of an individual game, I think that helps potentially. But even if it doesn't, the more attention that you draw to how ridiculous this Hacka stuff is and you make them ruin the game with it, then, you know, if you have Andre Drummond locked up for the next 5 years, as they probably will this summer, get that rule changed. Make it look ridiculous. Like, it's better for your franchise ultimately.
And also, if, as we've posited many times, the goal of it is to get that player off the floor. If you take that off the table, it takes away a lot of the incentive to do it in the first place. From a game theory perspective, if you take one of the incentives off the table, that should change behavior. And if it doesn't, then that's kind of their fault.
Well, so what do you think is the best counter argument to what I'm saying here? I mean, you could say, all right, he's just going to keep missing, right? You know, you're going to kill your team. I mean, that's one. I mean, is there anything else that why that's just a bad strategy, you think?
With certain teams, being in the half court defense might not be as much of an advantage, but Detroit is a team that it should be. And also, like, I guess a lot of the arguments there would be that, oh, you know, you can counteract that. The team that is hacking could counteract that and put better offensive players and stuff on the floor. But the fact of the matter is, generally, they don't. You know, this is something I talked about with Kevin Pelton when we did our podcast that talked a lot about this, is that teams haven't been willing to go whole hog into Hacka as a strategy as much as they should. Like, if you're going to do that, do it. And so I think there's a lot more to exploit there in the time that they're not doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there was a time back in the 50s when the Fort Wayne Pistons won a game 19-18 because there was no shot clock and they just stalled for the entire game. And guess what? The league stepped in and said, all right, we need a shot clock. We have to fix this. Our product is getting unwatchable. Well, you know, if you want to make every game either, all right, on one end, it's going to be hack a Drummond and we're going to score 39% of the time. And not only is it going to be boring, but it's going to be interminable. And then on the other end, we're going to have our defense set. So there's going to be no offense there either. You know, just make them take this to its logical conclusion, and I'm a little surprised that no one has done that yet. I mean, a couple of those Shaq games, it happened, but you know, that's really the only times that I can think of that they've just refused to acquiesce under any circumstances.
I'll tell a quick story. So there was an Oregon high school game when I was in college where one of the teams, because they don't have a shot clock, basically held the ball for an entire half, and that's because they wanted to take the ball away from a then senior in high school, Kevin Love. I think the game ended like 11-5 or something like that.
Yeah, this game is a little bit faster paced than you would have thought, but the Pistons only 6 out of 23 from deep. Marcus Morris, obviously, his game is like ISO post. You would expect he'd be completely erased by Kawhi. He was. He was 1 out of 6 in this game. He, Ilyasova, Reggie Jackson, Stanley Johnson, they combined for 7 made field goals among those guys, which is not going to get it done. I mean, only Drummond, Caldwell Pope, and Baines were the only guys who were really scoring at all for the Pistons.
Oh, one more thing I wanted, you talked about it and I didn't follow up on it with Reggie Jackson, is it's something that is hard for me sometimes. It's one of my, not a misevaluation, it's just something you have to deal with. Dennis Schroeder might be another guy like this, of certain players just don't maximize their athleticism on the defensive end. And so you think of these intuitive advantages, like Tayshaun Prince is another guy who had that but used it. And at a certain point, you just have to go, okay, well, maybe that's just not who they are.
Yeah, I mean, Reggie Jackson has, I think he is pretty close to a 7-foot wingspan. He's one of the longest wingspans of anyone. Certainly the longest I can remember of anyone who is like 6'1 or whatever he is. But he's not quick. Now, he was struggling a little bit with an ankle sprain, it appeared, in this game also. That might be something to monitor for a couple games going forward.
But he's just not that kind of a guy. And, you know, like Marcus Smart had that kind of profile, and he has done it. So you never really know. But there, at a certain point, you just kind of have to stop giving somebody credit for their potential.
All right, before we get to the news, why don't we have a couple words from our sponsors? All right, we were going to talk a little bit about Bulls-Bucks, but don't really have time for that. I didn't see that much of it anyway, except for down the stretch. Just two small notes. One is that Derrick Rose was unable to finish the game due to a strained left patellar tendon. Let Casey Johnson and Vince Goodwill are going to just get a chance to write more Rose newsers now. I'm sure they're really looking forward to that. Those Bulls beat guys. And it's really a shame for Rose. I think the strategy just has to be whenever he gets going, and he actually has been playing pretty darn well, offensively, whenever he gets going, there's just another setback like this, just a little small nagging injury. And trying to play with those is what can lead to the larger injuries. So, I think the strategy really needs to be just play him 25 minutes a game, you know, give him the Tony Parker treatment and just try to have him be healthy for the playoffs and maybe try to trade for a little bit better option at backup point guard since, you know, they used their mid-level on Aaron Brooks instead of, someone who could be a little bit more of a facsimile of a starter.
I had this crazy idea. I was talking about it with Sean Hyken offline about the idea of them trading Pau Gasol and involving Mario Chalmers in the trade. Just because I'm not saying those are the principal pieces, but I'm just like, there was something about that I like.
Yeah, this whole Gasol brothers playing together in Memphis thing, I don't know why anybody thinks that would actually like be good from a basketball
standpoint. Oh, it wouldn't be. It certainly would not be, but it would be kind of interesting. I mean,
go on. Yeah, we have a lot of news to get through, actually.
We do.
It's been a while. Stan Van Gundy said that the Pistons plan to guarantee Ersan Ilyasova's contract for next season. He has only $400,000 guaranteed, but he's due about $8 million. He's starting for them. He's shooting pretty well on threes these last 2 years after a rough year during that disastrous 2013-14 for the Bucks where everyone got injured. So I think he's probably worth $8 million, don't you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that was always a part of that trade that I really liked for them was the idea of functionally having a team option, actually more favorable than a team option because it's non-guaranteed. And with the way that everything is going to be going in July, that's going to look like a bargain, especially when you don't have to make a long-term commitment. I mean, Ersan's a guy that if you can make a 1-8, that's a lot different than like 3-24 or something like that.
This will not warm your heart, Danny. Jordan Adams, another knee surgery, supposedly out 6 to 8 weeks. We talked about this before, but we only saw him basically on the court for one game, that terrible blowout that the Warriors had when they were up 50. I think it seemed like he played more minutes than he had to or was supposed to in that game, and then wasn't able to finish that game, has been trying to rehab since then, and now he's having another surgery.
Second young guy who kind of their highlight of their season this year was just being in a game at Oracle when a time that wasn't really necessary. The other guy being Sam Decker in the preseason.
Rudy Gobert is back for the Jazz from that
warms my heart.
Strained MCL. They are 10-6 with him in the starting lineup. Immediately, their defense has gotten good again. They're on a nice winning streak now. They're getting back to playing that defense that looked so good at the end of last year. Derek Favors is supposed to come back. I think there's talk that he's going to play against Portland. So I think if they now can get to where they're pretty healthy and start defending again, the offense actually has been in the top half of the league amazingly despite all the injuries that they've had. I think that they can start really solidifying that spot, especially now with New Orleans again back in the crapper.
I think they should be an over 500 team at the end of the season. I think they might even be a little bit more than that. And that also changes the West playoff picture to be a little bit more like what we expected. Right now they're 17-20. I don't think anybody really expects that, though you always have to account for the fact that somebody could fall off due to an injury above them, and that may make it a little bit easier, but that changes it. You know, it's not, I think it's going to be closer, as I kind of always thought, they'll be closer to 500 at when all is said and done to get into the West playoffs.
Another one that we've got, David Pick, who reported that LaMarcus was going to San Antonio actually a couple days before it happened last year. He says that Dario Saric is definitely Sixers bound next season, 100%, which is interesting because if he waited another year, he could be outside the rookie scale. But on the other hand, I think he wants to kind of get his career started. So we'll see. I mean, he might actually be able to make himself a little more money if he waited. But, the talk has always been that it was going to be 2 years, and this is consistent with that.
Yeah, I phrased it earlier that it's consistently surprising to me that Saric has been this consistent about it, but that's the way it is at this point. You know, you have to take it at face value, and yeah, it probably would cost him some money in a sense, though at the same point, jump-starting your... Well, actually, I guess the argument would be that you're not jump-starting your second contract will be, if you're optimistic, will be good for him. But he's a guy that I want to see in the league, and I'm very encouraged by that, especially considering how, even though the Sixers are playing better, any talent they get is a positive.
Some news on John Wall. Some negative news. He is scheduled to undergo a precautionary MRI on his left VMO muscle, that is vastus medialis oblique, which is medial, basically means closer to the middle of your body. Lateral means closer to the outside. And so that is a muscle in your quad that's basically right above the knee and a little bit closer to the center line of your body. That muscle is very important in determining knee stability, making sure that the patella, that your kneecap tracks straight when you bend your knee, when you try to explode. And so if he has some sort of an issue with that, that is something that could potentially lead to more knee problems. He did have those knee problems early in his career. So not great. He's been playing through it. We'll have to see what that MRI says. But again, you know, it's interesting for the Wizards. They are kind of in the same situation, it seems like, as New Orleans, where they are getting close to being out of it now. I mean, maybe what you can say is when Beal comes back, which is supposed to be relatively imminent now, you give it one more go, a couple of weeks with Wall and Beal, and then, you know, if Wall has had a bunch of issues, maybe you shut him down for a little bit and try to, you know, get a better draft pick. That might be, you know, basically punting on the Kevin Durant dream forever. But, you know, it looks like that's pretty unrealistic anyway.
I disagree on the... I think there are fundamental differences between those two circumstances, but those differences might not matter. I think that the Wizards are better relative to their competition for the playoffs than the Pelicans are. And I think they're closer to be... Maybe not closer to being 100%, but I think their 100% is better relative, I guess is the better way to put it. But at the same time, you know, if they fall back a little bit more, then even playing pretty well might not be enough. So I think they should give it a go for a little bit. But Beal, it kind of sounds a little bit optimistic, the last thing I read. So I you know, but at a certain point, you know, by Valentine's Day, you're gonna need to know either way. And so I think that's going to be the way to do it. But for Washington at this point, really, I mean, obviously they can shut players down, but from a personnel perspective, there isn't really much of a difference between, you know, going forward and not going forward. It's more from a minutes distribution standpoint, which is better in that sense because you're not making kind of the same choices and sacrifices.
Wall also, in business news, he is leaving Dan Fagan and Relativity Sports. It's actually the second big loss for Relativity with DeAndre Jordan leaving after the fireworks over the summer. I think you would have to imagine that is related to Wall's contract with Adidas. I read a piece about it today on nicekicks.com, which said basically he was making about $5 million a year or so, that, or at least that's what he would have made with incentives. It's unclear whether he made those incentives or not. That contract expired. He was theoretically going to re-up with Adidas. He wanted like $10 million a year. That was deemed, you know, his shoes have never sold particularly well. That was deemed to be a little bit high. And supposedly they're going to compromise around 7, and then Well, surprisingly, at least to Adidas, rejected that deal, and he's now basically going to be a free agent. He's been spotted wearing some Nikes at times, but you know, Nike already has Kyrie Irving, who would sort of be in what John Wall's spot would be. But now he's going to be signing with Rich Paul of Clutch Sports. That's the LeBron agency. And I think, you know, with LeBron's role at Nike, you would expect that this would lead to Wall getting a shoe deal with Nike. But, you know, there's not really space for him. So you kind of wonder about what's going on there. I think also maybe Wall had some dissatisfaction because you remember he had those comments over the summer about how Reggie Jackson was making as much as him. Although, he signed his deal during a different time. He was still, you know, not established as a star yet when he signed his maximum extension. So I don't think Dan Fagan deserves any blame there, but maybe John Wall thought that he did.
That's the way that happens when you're dealing with players sometimes. And yeah, I'm sad that you're not counting Austin Rivers as a major defection from Relativity. But with Wall, it's kind of one of those things where we don't know the whole story. But from a personality standpoint, I don't know if people have been there where it's like, where even if the disappointment isn't really the other person's fault, sometimes you throw it on them because it's related to what the other person, your relationship with them. And so I think it might be some of that. But at the same point, you know, he's under his contract and all that. And Rich Paul, I think it's something like 10 of his 11 clients are Nike clients. So there's obviously a connection there, which we already knew.
Yeah, but that, I mean, they're starting to build up a pretty good stable. It's Eric Bledsoe, LeBron, Tristan Thompson, now John Wall. And Paul has done pretty well for those guys, frankly.
Yeah, he has.
And you know, there's kind of a feedback loop on that. The more important guys you get, the more you can kind of power broker and get what you want as an agent. We have a trade.
Technically. There are multiple picks involved, supposedly.
Yeah. The Cavs traded Joe Harris, a 2017 second-round pick, and cash to Orlando for a 2020 second-round pick. Both of the picks are apparently top 55 protected, and so this is essentially the Cavs trading Harris to the Magic for cash. They are deep into luxury tax land, so this will save them over $3 million. Harris is making about $900,000, but that gets multiplied because of where they're at in the tax. So that's how it ends up saving the money, and Harris is if not out for the year, pretty darn close to it, having a foot injury. But it does allow us to harken back to early last year when Joe Harris actually started some games for the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Before they added their depth through their cap magic. And I think a lot of people have focused on the money that Cleveland saved. For me, the bigger benefit that they got was having a roster spot. So that means that they can do some things with 10-day contracts, or theoretically, if they wanted to, if Dan Gilbert was willing to pony up the money with either of their trade exceptions, because they have a trade exception for Mike Miller and a trade exception for Haywood. And if they wanted to use one or both of those this season, now that's a lot more workable. And what I, meaning a couple hours ago, said was that once they decided to keep Jared Cunningham, I thought this, I thought that this was something that could happen, because a team like Cleveland, if they didn't think Joe Harris was a part of their long-term solution, it's better to just cycle through and try to find something else and use that to a more cohesive benefit. And for Orlando, I mean, why not give him a try? There's not really much risk for them.
Well, the Cleveland will always have Joe Harris getting back cut on a fake zipper cut by Manu Ginobili for a game-winning layup against the Spurs early last year that in many ways sort of typified that early season nadir for Cleveland. But this, you mentioned Jared Cunningham getting guaranteed. That is now the case that all NBA contracts that were non-guaranteed are now guaranteed. They can still be cut, obviously, but they're going to get paid. And now 10-day contracts can be signed as well. And so the rules on 10-day contracts are on January 5th or the first business day after that, teams can sign a 10-day contract with a player. It's the longer. It's not technically 10 days necessarily. It could also be three games, whichever is longer. And the player gets a prorated minimum salary for that period, and then you can do one more 10-day contract with the player, and then you need to either waive them or sign them for the rest of the season. And so we did not see a lot of guys get waived. In fact, with Sean Kilpatrick signing in Denver, and Elliot Williams. Who did he go to, by the way, Elliot Williams?
I'm not sure. I don't think I heard that, but congratulations to Elliot Williams.
Yeah, he was one of the guys that was talked about as one of the best guys in the D-League. He got called up actually right from Santa Cruz right before the D-League showcase. But now New Orleans, Phoenix, Utah, the Knicks, and Orlando are the only, and assuming Orlando waives Harris,
which I don't think they're going to do personally.
Those are the only teams with open roster slots, and that is a big difference from what we've seen in past years. Either because teams were worried about not making enough money, because there are 15 spots and you only have to have 13 players. But it also meant that the D-League showcase wasn't as interesting because a lot of those players, either there's no room for them to be called up or they're not as good because a lot of them are kind of, 30 of them are in the league when there would have just been open roster slots in previous years.
And what I found so kind of fascinating about the way that teams have made these choices this year is that the end of last year featured arguably one of the greatest success stories of the 10-day contract period in Tyler Johnson.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Heat had been really onto him for a long time. But yeah, I mean, I really, being at the showcase, talking to people, it does not seem like they're kind of that level of guys who are not, already being assigned from the NBA. So I think that it's, there's always going to be somebody, but I mean, I think they're going to have to be injuries and waivers for those guys to even get a chance. Although there is a note that the fact that all these rosters are full is an indication of the financial health of the league, both because there are more teams that use cap space. And so just your team salary is just not going to be as high in a year that you use cap space as when you're operating over the cap. And also just, they can afford to have a few more players on the roster. Nobody's saying save money by, save a couple million bucks by not filling out slots 14 and 15.
Yeah, and I think as a consequence of that, from what I heard, it seemed like a lot of the players who were the best there were not players who were showcasing themselves for other teams in that sense. It was more guys that were on rosters already.
Yeah, they are. And so I guess the D-League showcase, it's basically four games a day. All the teams in the D-League play. It's 5 days worth of games. I was there for 3.5 of those days. Those are some long games. It's not like it's like summer league, maybe even a little bit worse than summer league quality, but 48 minutes instead of 40. So that's a little rough. At least there aren't 10 fouls to foul out. Although you'll be pleased to know that Tarik Black came perilously close to fouling out of a game once again for the Defenders.
That summer league foul out is one of the highlights of my 2015. Honestly, it is.
Well, all right. So let me talk a little bit about some of the players I saw. The guy who I thought was the best non-assigned player was probably Ronald Roberts on Raptors 905. He's a bouncy, power forward size guy. I mean, basically center skill set. Not someone who's going to really excite you, but someone who I think could sort of be, a Mavs-style backup center, run some pick and rolls, get some alley-oops on the second unit, pretty quick feet, go over and block a couple of shots. So I think he's someone who probably deserves a call-up. But, yeah, I mean, there weren't really any other players. I mean, Kilpatrick and Elliot Williams were already called up, and they're really talking to other people of, who potential call-ups could be. There wasn't a lot of consensus on the names, and there weren't that many names given to me to begin with.
So no Jimmer buzz?
No, there is not any Jimmer buzz. I mean, I think kind of what people were thinking about him is that it's at some point soon he's probably going to end up in Europe, and just that's especially as a guy who can kind of handle that from a mental standpoint a little bit better. That once he doesn't get called up this year, I think that'll probably be his fate.
What did you hear anything interesting in terms of players who are under NBA contract?
Yeah, everyone was saying that Jordan Mickey, who is out of LSU, I think I want to say he was the 33rd pick this year for the Celtics. He actually, I think, got the richest contract ever for a second rounder, at least who had never played before. And he's the best big in the D-League, plays for the Maine Red Claws. The way they play is basically he's the only big, and then they have four shooters around him. They actually, a lot of people say that they play kind of a more European style, moving the ball from side to side. I like just their overall philosophy. And he played well in the two games that he was there. really just, you know, especially when he gets on the offensive glass, his athleticism, quickness, shot blocking ability. He also actually even can shoot some pick and pop threes as well. You know, probably not quite center size in the NBA, but at that level, just was really able to overwhelm guys physically, even though he was playing center most of the time.
And my colleague Jonathan Charks wrote a nice piece on Real GM about him. I can't remember if it was right after he was drafted. It was sometime between when he was drafted and I think the end of last year. And he's one of those guys who has a lot of physical potential and it's just going to take him some time.
It'll be interesting to see what position he ends up playing. He's a guy who I think could hold up as a backup five on the second unit. Maybe not necessarily a starting level player ultimately, but he does have an intriguing skill set with his ability to take threes, block shots. I mean, if he's playing as a pure power forward, he would be one of the better shot blockers as a power forward. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, how good his perimeter defensive skills are. He's okay switching, but you probably need more than that even if you're going to really and whether he can guard NBA wings if the other team goes small. I don't know. I think he's still kind of a little bit better as a small ball center. But if he can continue to develop his skills, maybe he could also play little four. It just depends on what the system is going to demand.
Yeah, I'd love to see him get a few minutes towards the end of the season or at some point with Olynyk, because I think they would kind of mirror each other in a cool way with strengths and weaknesses.
Terry Rozier was also down from Boston. He was the 16th pick in the draft this last year. He didn't impress me as much as Jordan Mickey did. He shot the ball well on three-pointers, and he had a few okay pick and roll moves. Like there are flashes of some advanced moves where you get the guy on his back, throw a nice alley-oop, but in general did not show a ton of refinement in the pick and roll. He really would always like go too early before the screen even got there. And that was actually one of the things that about the D League that you'll see is there's just a lot less craft. And you know, it's younger players, guys who aren't as good, you expect that. But you know, whether it's setting screens, cutting back door, just like, you know, faking guys into the air and then getting a foul, like all those kind of crafty plays that we see in the NBA, you don't see a ton of those in the D League. And so Terry, you know, has some good athleticism, but a lot of times you get in the lane and kind of take off too early, kind of throw up a floater or you know, he's playing actually in the game. He was playing against a pretty good shot blocker. And so he definitely has a long way to go as far as advanced operation in the pick and roll, making the right passes to the weak side. And especially, I think the biggest thing is finishing at the basket out of pick and roll situations.
As a draft prospect, I had kind of written him off earlier in his time at Louisville because he felt to me like a man without a country, which is that he's a guy who has point guard size and decent athleticism for the position, but he can't really run it. I didn't trust him to run an NBA offense long-term or short-term. And it sounds to me like that's kind of where he's been going. And obviously guys can get better. I get proven wrong all the time, but that is what I was thinking going in.
Spencer Dinwiddie was down from Detroit with the Grand Rapids Drive. Saw him play a couple of games. Not particularly impressed with him, which pains me to say since he's one of the few NBA players who actually follows me on Twitter. But he did not show really stand out from an athleticism standpoint in that setting, which is always a little worrisome because the athleticism is really, you know, significantly lower. I mean, even someone like Phil Pressey really stood out with like how much quicker he was kind of than everyone else. And he's not a guy who just absolutely wows you at the NBA level. Dinwiddie, you know, at about 6'4", 6'5", and a point guard, can shoot the ball. You know, he operates in a controlled manner, but just other than his shooting, haven't really seen much. And I mean, he hasn't been a great shooter in the NBA so far, but you know, he can take a three pointer as a point guard. I didn't really see a ton to recommend him. Also, KJ McDaniels played a couple games with Rio Grande Valley Vipers down from Houston. And, you know, a coach told me who I was talking to during their game that part of the reason that he hasn't been playing is because his defensive footwork is really bad. And that when he's been down there, they've always had like a really bad plus minus. Part of that is because, you know, he's not part of the system, but you know, he didn't seem to be incredibly engaged in the game for a lot of it. You know, the type of guy who was looking at it as like a punishment. And you can understand that mentality a little bit because he played, you know, a lot early on with Philly. And, you know, I think at least he thought that he was successful during those periods. And he actually shot great on threes. He was like 5-8 of threes in that game. He had a very efficient game, showed some flashes of his athleticism, but definitely coasted a lot at times. And if he's going to really be an impact player in the league, he's got to play 1,000 miles an hour all the time, and did not really show that, and just really needs to work on his defensive technique, because now, you know, the idea of him as potentially a 3-and-D guy is a lot more of just an idea than actuality, just due to his lack of fundamentals at this point.
And he's still young-ish. He's 22, but he'll turn 23 in a couple weeks. And that's when you kind of need to see that light switch turn on if it hasn't turned on already.
All right, we have a lot of stuff to plug before we go, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I think we should start with your stuff. Your piece was very good.
That's good. Well, I guess I only write once a week, so it's... So when I was down at the showcase, I spent a lot of my time just having some conversations with executives there, basically anyone I could talk to, bouncing around ideas for the next CBA. Maybe not enormous in a macro sense, but just kind of little things that could make the league run more easily, a little bit fairer. Definitely take the chance to read that. We will probably discuss some of those issues on a future podcast, maybe on a slower day when we haven't watched games. So I enjoyed doing that. What about you?
I think the piece that I wrote, the piece that I wrote for the Sporting News was on the Nets. So that was on, I tried to kind of phrase it in terms of silver linings. I'm somebody who's been very into the idea of the big market advantages in this CBA, and I've been very frustrated that they haven't used them. So I wrote kind of about how the Nets can do some of those things despite not having any
cake pops in the media room for like 1 year.
What?
They use that as, that was part of what they use as their big market advantage. They had cake pops in the media room.
That is true.
1 year. And then they've cut back actually in the last 2 years as they've kind of retrenched. But yeah, like the Pierce Garnett year, they had apparently all kinds of stuff, awesome food in the media room, but that's no longer the case.
And also for listeners of this show, in particular, I've been lapsing on it a little bit, recently, but the CBA Encyclopedia, I wrote a new piece for it on the disabled player exception, which sadly is relevant right now with both Jarrett Jack and Martell Webster. And the idea with the CBA Encyclopedia, many of you hopefully know, is that it's a permanent resource. So these are the types of things that are going to be around. They're going to be hopefully on Real GM for a long time. It's a site that hopefully will be around for a while. It's already been around a while. So, you know, if you ever need to consult it, I'm working on having it for basically every issue. And it's the idea of it is why I called it the CBA Encyclopedia is to that it can be more kind of in depth on a single issue, and then they connect with each other. So it's a good way to get into it, and there's a lot of other material already up there, and we're working on more every week.
All right, well, that'll do it for us today. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. On days like today when I'm doing a game episode, I will usually live tweet so you can get all of my observations in real time and then hear me repeat them on the podcast, but hopefully elaborate a little bit. Danny is Danny LaRue, and then our Facebook pages is where you can keep up with the aforementioned writing. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue NBA. That cap space code on SeatGeek is a great way to support the podcast, and just as good a one is to give us an iTunes review or rating. Those definitely really help us out a lot, and we hope that you'll give us a high rating. And also just any kind of feedback, telling a friend. If you have any suggestions for the show, we love hearing that. We've actually come up with a couple of show ideas that people have given us via Twitter, and a couple that we're going to do in the future. So thanks so much for listening. We will talk to you all next time.